take a deep breath, take the higher road. That's what they always say, as if they know the way. They won't take it from me. But don't ever doubt yourself, it's life ain't just a dream. You make your own, so kick and scream. The people move alike with a never-ending force. You never had the chance, so what you waiting for? The day has come, my friend, cause this is war.
CEO of HCA Healthcare, Sam Hazen, recently reported $1.13 billion in net profits for Q3 of this year. I want to counter 3 points he made during his earning calls to investors to challenge the strength of his optimism for ongoing growth in 2023. I resigned from an HCA hospital after less than 30 days, and here is the exit interview no one in leadership seemed to be interested in. I'm sure the investors would love to know. Welcome to Nurses Out Loud. I'm your host, Nurse April. I plan on reading several quotes from articles I reviewed recently, so you have a decent amount of foundational data. I'll include links to these articles in show notes so you can do your own research. I'm curious to see what listeners have to say about these issues. Just as an aside, you can send me or any of the Nurses Out Loud hosts an email directly by going to the America Out Loud website, pull up the show Nurses Out Loud, and share your stories with us. We want to hear what's going on where you live. Consider it a personal therapy session covered under HIPAA. As a reporter, I promise to keep my sources protected so you don't have to worry about retaliation from employers. We all really want you to feel free to spill the dirt on your experiences. I've always believed that our silence is the reason for our suffering. So let's use this platform to finally tell the world our side of the story. Maybe we can use the power we gain from having strength in numbers to bring about change in this broken system. We'll be your voice until you're ready to speak your truth out loud. Now, back to the report. A few months ago, a report came out in Becker's that said, during an earnings call with investors back in October, Chief Financial Officer Bill Rutherford reported a 19% reduction in contract labor costs in the third quarter compared to the second quarter. The reduction meant that the 182 hospital for-profit health system was able to absorb much of the market-based wage adjustment cost for its employee workforce. So, in other words, by hiring fewer needed contract employees, and decreasing the wages of those they did bring on to do what patients and insurers are actually paying them to do, they were able to reallocate money to give their employees a much needed market wage adjustment. That's interesting. Chief Executive Officer Sam Hazen said the system's salary, wage, and benefit costs per hour were flat with the second quarter, which he called, quote, encouraging. That's the first quarter in a while where we've seen stabilization in our labor cost per hour when you mix all components of our labor cost. So we'll continue to hopefully make some strides in that area and moderate some of the pressures that exist in the labor market as we continue to execute on our recruitment agenda, our retention agenda, our capacity management, and so forth, end quote. Now, some of what he said, it's a worthy goal. It's what we want. We want you to increase recruitment. We need more staff. We need more staff to stay so we can handle the capacity. But the question that I have is, how exactly do you plan to do that without overburdening your workforce? Mr. Hazen had also said HCA continued to invest significantly in its workforce, including with the opening of one more Galen College of Nursing campus. He said these investments produced improvements in new hires and retention, in addition to reducing contract labor expenses. So, by hiring new graduate nurses at a lower cost to the system, you were able to get rid of the more experienced travel nurses. Let's fast forward a little bit to the beginning of this month, when third quarter earnings were finally reported and they held their quarterly earnings call. The strategy they reported in October seemed to be effective because HCA was able to report a net earning of $1.13 billion for the third quarter. Not gross, net. I take that to mean that after all the bills were paid, they had $1.13 billion of discretionary income. Now let's see what Sam had to say during the call. One thing I wanted to share are the themes that we believe are takeaways from our quarter and sort of the normal business trends that we were judging between the second and third quarter. And these themes are as follows. First, again, we think our top line metrics are stable and normal seasonality patterns are beginning to show themselves. Number two, we're making progress on our human resource agenda. Our engagement levels are up, and so we're encouraged by that. Number three, inflation is real. It's a pressure point, but we're working our way through it with resiliency agenda and other initiatives. And then fourth, is that long-term growth prospects, we believe, exist across our portfolio. First, I want to address the problem from his initial statement. Again, this is what he said. We think our top-line metrics are stable and normal seasonality patterns are beginning to show themselves. Okay, so first, in addressing his claim regarding top-line metrics, which I assume refer back to the stabilization in labor costs they reported in October, if you're putting a Band-Aid over a crack in the wall of a dam, what's going to happen when the seasonality patterns you mentioned start to impact the workforce? For my listeners, let me start by explaining what he means by seasonality pattern. Hospitals' top-line revenue stream comes from surgical procedures. I'm pretty sure most people can relate to what thoughts go through your head when you finally hit your insurance deductible at the end of the year. You start thinking of all the things you want to get done, get fixed before things reset in January, right? So at the end of the year, we see this major influx of surgical procedures. It's great. It's because it's a major driver of revenue that the hospital uses throughout the next year to sustain operating costs during slower times. So it's just like what happens during the Christmas spending season for major retailers. Now, I don't know much about investing or running a hospital. However, I'm curious to know how decreasing staffing, wages, and overall labor costs during the busiest time of the year can have a positive effect on the bottom line in the short and long term. Remember that Band-Aid over the leaking hole back, holding back the dam? I have a feeling this strategy he has is going to lead them into the perfect storm. Now, I'm new to this whole projecting future earnings, so I'm going to keep my eye to see if my assumptions are correct. But if they are, I think HCA is gearing up to start losing money over the next year. And if I were a gambler, I'd say it's time to start to short this stock. Now, I want to address the second and third statement together. If you recall, he said, number two, we're making progress on our human resource agenda. Our engagement levels are up, so we're encouraged by that. Number three, inflation is real. It's a pressure point, but we're working our way through it with our resiliency agenda and other initiatives. Two of his statements regarding wages and inflation are like poking the bear. Mr. Hazen, you are correct. Despite what the Biden administration would have us to believe, inflation is very real. And those who feel it the most are not the ones who have $999 million in their cash reserves like HCA. Your human resource agenda to decrease costs by hiring more nurses to work for lower wages while using less agency and travelers is not working. I've seen it firsthand, and I'll bring the receipts later. If you believe that your reduction in nursing wages is an encouraging way to achieve your 2023 financial goals, as you've previously stated, I'd like to point out some statistics that suggest that attempting this strategy will be an exercise in futility. Here's some data from a recent article by Ethan Popowitz titled "Addressing the Healthcare Staffing Shortage." Ethan states that since 2020, one in five healthcare workers have quit their jobs, and surveys suggest that up to 47% of healthcare workers plan to leave their position by 2025. Let me repeat that. 47% of healthcare workers plan to leave their positions by 2025. The U.S. is suffering from a significant healthcare worker shortage, and early data shows that this is going to have near-term and long-term effects on both patient care and hospital and physician performance. In 2021, 100,000 nurses left the profession. Did you hear that? 100,000 nurses left the profession in 2021, which is the greatest drop in nursing ever seen over the last 40 years. Headline after headline details the staffing crisis we are experiencing in healthcare, but they aren't really talking about the reality of how this is directly impacting patient safety. There were 18 nursing strikes across the nation in 2022. Across the board, the demands were consistent. We wanted better staffing, safer nurse-to-patient ratios, and higher pay. Oh, and safer working environments. According to an article titled "The New Nurse is the New Normal" by Epic Research Firm, between March 2021 and March 2022, median nursing tenure fell by 19.5%. Shifts covered by nurses new to the organization in the last 30 days increased in all regions. The number of 12-hour shifts filled by nurses new to the organization within the last year also rose by 55.5%. Later on in the show, I'm going to tell you why that matters. Travel nurses aren't returning to their old jobs, Mr. Hazen. I'm not sure if you read the latest article by Erica Carbajal from Becker's Hospital Review, but here's what she said. In January of 2020, right before the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, there were about 50,000 travel nurses in the U.S. That number doubled to at least 100,000 as the coronavirus began spreading. Lucrative travel pay led to many hospital staff nurses leaving their jobs. Now, nurses who once earned $5,000 or more a week on travel assignments earn less than half of that as demand for travel nurses drops. NBC reports that travel nurse demand dropped 42% from January to July of this year. But the drop in demand and pay isn't luring all travel nurses back to their old hospital jobs. The news outlet spoke to 9 travel nurses across the U.S. who are now considering alternate career paths. Some said they're starting their own businesses, and others are studying for advanced degrees so they can leave bedside nursing. Nurses who want to leave the field point to patient safety concerns amid growing workloads. People say it's burnout, but it's not. Pamela Esmond, RN, who became a travel nurse during the pandemic, told NBC, "It's the moral injury of watching patients not being taken care of on a day-to-day basis. You just can't take it anymore." Ms. Esmond, 59, plans to continue working as a travel nurse until she retires at 65. "I would love to go back to staff nursing, but on my staff job, I would never be able to retire." Finally, I want to evaluate the problem with his final statement. So, just as a reminder, this is what he said. "Long-term growth prospects, we believe, exist across our portfolio." It seems they're referring to their new Galen School of Nursing, but I wouldn't be so quick to put all your eggs in that basket. Investing in the younger generation of nurses doesn't correlate with long-term retention. A major focus for HCA is in opening nursing schools in the hopes of training a new workforce. But it fails to address the actual reason you can't retain these younger nurses longer than 3 years. For several years now, when you poll younger nurses who leave the profession, their primary complaints are the same: lack of mentorship and lack of training. Even if you can attract new talent, can you retain them? They say the cost of nurse turnover is $40,000. So if you haven't figured out how to keep your nursing staff, you might want to reevaluate the advice that you're getting from your leadership circle, because mentorship and training can only come from building sustained trusting relationships with older, more seasoned nurses who happen to cost more money. Either you pay for that hard-won expertise, or you deal with settling increased number of malpractice lawsuits that have very hefty price tags. I don't understand why it's so hard for these executives to understand that in order to truly invest in nursing and to really give us what we're asking for, which is a safe working environment so that we can protect our patients and actually care for them the way that we're intended to, you have to invest in the staff. It costs money. But I promise you that if you were to invest in nursing, and if you were to pay nurses fair salaries, wages, commensurate with the work that they're doing, we could turn this whole ship around. If your focus is on the new nurse, here's what I hope you know. This is what you need to know. David Orbeck and colleagues exposed a chilling new finding about the younger nurses leaving. This is what he said. A sustained reduction in the number of younger age RNs would raise ominous implications for the future workforce. Because nurses typically remain working in nursing over their career, a reduction of younger nurses in the workforce would exert an impact that is felt over a generation. In contrast to a relatively modest reduction in long-run nurse supply due to early retirement of the baby boomer nurses working into their 60s and 70s, 2 years of pandemic stress may be having longer-term impacts as nurses reflect on their work environments and experiences as hospitals coped with pandemic staffing. Significantly larger efforts to support and sustain early career nurses who have had a trial by fire in their new profession may be needed, along with more effective strategies to reward those who remain at the front lines and those who are needed to return. Now, that was a nice way of saying what I'm going to say. David made 3 points I want to touch on. One, as nurses reflect on their work environments and experiences as hospitals coped with pandemic staffing, I wonder what they think that reflection entails. I'm going to share with you what nurses are saying in regards to how hospitals coped with pandemic staffing. These are some points that you need to consider. Nurses who remained on staff earned significantly less than those who traveled. Our takeaway: we are undervalued and underpaid. If you could find the money to pay them, why couldn't you find the money to pay us? Number two, forced vaccination in order to keep my job? Our takeaway: you're perfectly okay with me risking my life to care for patients when it benefits your bottom line. But as soon as the government payer says they will financially constrain your profits, you throw me straight under the bus. When they dangle the carrot of financial incentives for getting employees vaccinated, you threaten our families and our livelihoods. When they dangle the carrot of high payments for unsupported scientific treatment protocols that we see are killing our patients, you threaten to take away our licenses, silence our speech, threaten us with lawsuits and possible criminal charges. So no loyalty for you equals no loyalty from me. You made us believe our actions in healthcare were backed by science, but now we know those scientific studies were funded by big corporations with financial incentives, shrouded as science, to gain our compliance. You made us the enforcers of your agenda. Listen to this quote from a nurse from a Medscape poll. She said, "I'm a practicing ER nurse of 25 years. The amount of blood clots, strokes, cardiac events like myocarditis, pericarditis, Bell's palsy, shingles, etc., that I've seen since the vaccine rollout is more than I've ever seen in the previous 23 and a half years combined. I don't know how anyone can't be frightened by what they're seeing. When I try to discuss this with my coworkers, they turn their heads and look downcast, but will rarely speak. I think it's because, like me, they feel betrayed for following the narrative. But unlike me, they won't open their eyes and speak out. They're afraid for their careers and also are scared to death that their bodies are ticking time bombs. It's easier to ignore than to acknowledge." So that's from nurse Susan Pace. An article by Ed Young from The Atlantic said this: "Enough healthcare workers, nurses in particular, have quit their jobs that even when hospitals aren't deluged, the remaining workforce must care for an unreasonable number of patients over longer hours and more shifts." In a survey of nearly 12,000 nurses conducted by the American Nurses Foundation this January, 89% said that their workplace was short-staffed, and half said the problem was serious. Worse, almost a quarter said that they were planning on leaving their jobs within the next 6 months, and another 30% said they might. Even if just a small fraction of them follow through on their intentions, their departure would heap more pressure upon a workforce that is already shouldering too much. There's a palpable concern that this can't be our new normal. Truth is, your direct-facing patient care providers are overworked, underpaid, uninspired, and on their way out the door. I'm curious to know why Sam Hazen, the CEO of HCA, or Bill Rutherford, the CFO, haven't looked at this data and made the determination on behalf of investors to reverse course before it's too late, and they take a significant loss in the next year or so. Rather than continuing to put pressure on staff, why not reinvest your profits from this quarter and previous quarters into your workforce? Why not explain to investors that by making an investment in your forward-facing workforce, you're shoring up future earnings and profitability? That in order to prevent the collapse of your system, you're all going to have to make a temporary sacrifice in the distribution of dividends until you've weathered this storm. Something we as providers were told quite often when it comes to wage increases. Hospitals they've been traveling down the wrong course for so many years under the guidance of business professionals unfamiliar with the culture and pulse of healthcare, that if there is no dramatic course correction immediately, I promise you will see the U.S. healthcare system collapse. Unless Mr. Hazen has something up his sleeve that we aren't allowed to know, in regards to his claim that long-term growth prospects exist across their portfolio, well, that's, to me, nothing more than a pacifier to keep investors from having a meltdown and pulling out while they can.
It's time and this is
cold and flu season is here. Wouldn't it be great if you had a way to minimize airborne viral threats? Well, now there is, and it's a povidone iodine-based antiviral nasal spray called Cofix RX. You might even say it's just what the doctor ordered. To reduce your chance of getting hurt, you wear a safety belt when you're driving. To limit sun damage, you wear sunscreen on the beach. Cofix RX is just like that. It's an additional layer of protection. It's sold by thousands of pharmacists and medical doctors nationwide. It's made right here in the USA. Again, it's a povidone iodine-based antiviral nasal spray. You've heard them talk about it here on the Out Loud Network over and over again. Check out CofixRx.com. That's CofixRx.com for a retailer near you, or use coupon code OUTLOUD for 20% off at CofixRx.com.
Hello, I'm Ben Marble, MD, and I founded MyFreeDoctor.com as a donation-supported, faith-based nonprofit with a mission to save lives by delivering free doctor visits to patients in all 50 states of America. MyFreeDoctor.com treats a broad range of health concerns like COVID-19, long COVID, sinus infections, urinary tract infections, rashes, medication refills, and more. So please visit MyFreeDoctor.com, where we're healing America one person at a time.
The spirit of American liberty and justice is woven into the soul of America Out Loud. We are the voice of a nation, the American nation, that is. This is Malcolm Out Loud. I invite you back to AmericaOutLoud.com, where the fight for liberty and justice continues. America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Oral hygiene hasn't changed in 50 years, but our diet and the way we eat has, creating an environment in your mouth for bacteria to wreak havoc on your teeth and gums. For better oral health, get Spry Dental Defense, an oral care line designed to combat acid-creating bacteria. The toothpaste, mouthwash, mints, and gum all contain xylitol, a natural ingredient shown to dramatically improve oral health. Spry can be found online and at all fine natural retailers.
It's time and this is
so So in my humble nursing view, hospitals insist on stepping over dollars to save pennies. I want to share my firsthand experience of working for HCA to drive this point home. First, let's discuss patient safety. Let me give you a hypothetical example. I won't say anything specific in order to protect patient confidentiality, but I'm going to paint a picture to help you imagine what type of patient safety concerns exist within this and most hospitals across the nation. I'm not going to claim it's only here at HCA because I actually work in a lot of hospitals as an independent contractor, so I'm able to see the consistency throughout. When I started working at HCA, my orientation week, the first few days you have hospital orientation, system orientation, and then unit orientation. So the first day that I came to my unit, I was assigned to work in a room with a surgeon. Now, before I was assigned, they were trying to determine where they wanted me to go. And they're looking at the board, which has all of the procedures. Let me back this up. Hold on. Let me just tell you a little bit about my background. I am a registered nurse first assistant. I work in the operating room assisting in surgeries normally. As a business owner, I am an independent contractor. So I go and assist in surgeries when I'm scheduled by doctors. So that's why I say I go to different facilities. Now, I accepted this seasonal position in the operating room to supplement my income because during COVID, the government introduced the COVID relief package. And within that package, they had actually snuck in some legislation that effectively put me and a lot of my colleagues out of business. We're hanging on. We're trying to hang on. But for the most part, insurance companies are no longer reimbursing for our services. So it's been very difficult. In order to maintain, I decided to take this position as an operating room nurse circulating. I was looking at doing some contract assignments as a first assist in other states. And they actually paid more than this agency position that I took. It's not really agency. It was a seasonal nurse position. The contracts out of state were paying more as a first assist, but I wanted to stay local because I'm not ready to give up on my business completely. So in order to stay local, when I came across this particular job from an ad on Facebook, which I almost never go on Facebook, but I was on there one day just kind of scrolling through and there it popped up. Of course, they knew already that I had been looking because that's how it works nowadays. They spy on you. So anyway, they sent me this ad about finding a job and they let me know about this HCA position, which was a seasonal position. I decided to go ahead and take it because I thought, well, I still work in surgery. I know what the nurses do to circulate. I used to be a circulating nurse in the OR, so it can't be that hard to make that transition. One thing I was concerned about is how quickly I'd be able to catch on to the EHR system, the electronic health record system. HCA uses a very different system than the rest of the world. Everyone else has moved over to other systems. I'm not going to give them a free plug, but there are systems, well-known computer systems that most hospitals are using, and HCA is not one of them. They have their own system. It's proprietary. They created it. They own it. And they have no intentions of spending $1 billion+ investing in these other systems. And I completely understand that as a business owner. I wouldn't want to do that either. However, this computer system is ancient. It's really, really difficult to pick up. It reminds me of when I was a young child and we used to play on the computer. My mom is really into computers, so we always had computers at the house. And you know those computers when you had your floppy disks? Yeah. The system reminds me of that time period. It's not modern. It's not user-friendly. Everyone who works for HCA is fully aware of how bad this system is. So if I was picking up this position at any other facility, I could easily have picked up on the charting, but this was difficult for me. So on my first day, when they were trying to decide who they were going to put me with, they were looking at the board and they saw this one particular surgeon who is a very difficult surgeon to work with. But the nurse in the room, they assumed, would need some help. So they said, you know, why doesn't she go into the room, blah, 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 with so-and-so? One of the, I think it was the charge nurse, she said, well, you know, he has said he doesn't want any new grads in his room. So he's banned new graduate nurses from coming in his room. But they said, well, she's not a new grad. She has experience, so he should be okay with that. And I was like, yeah, I can handle a difficult physician. That's fine. So they send me into the room and I go in the room. And luckily for me, the nurse who was in there was receptive to my presence because working in the operating room, it can be very territorial. You never know what you're going to get. So this particular nurse was welcoming. She was glad to have the help. So we're running around trying to get the room ready, trying to find everything we need. And as I'm talking to her, I find out that she is not very familiar with this particular type of surgery. She doesn't work with this surgeon a lot. And so some of the equipment that we needed, she didn't know how to put together, and neither did I. But, you know, we got it together. And as soon as the surgeon comes into the room, he starts going off and telling us about how bad the room turnover is normally. It's normally an hour and a half, and he wasn't going to have any part of that. He had four cases scheduled, because in the beginning he had four. He ended up adding on another to make it five, but he had all these cases scheduled and he did not want to be there all day. So we were going to make sure that he had fast turnovers. He didn't want to wait. He had this really like, oh, he was, he didn't mince his words. And so here we are now, anxious, trying to make sure that we have everything ready and we can get his patient back in the room on time. We ran our butts off that shift. 12 hours we ran to make sure that we could get him out at a reasonable time. At one point, we took a 30-minute lunch break. And when we came back, he was so upset. He was mad. He did not think that we should have taken a break. Well, his concern was we shouldn't have taken a break at the same time that the scrub tech took a break. And from when I was on the other side of the table, I could understand that. But no, no, no. When you circulate a case, it's exhausting. So taking a break is something that you need to do. It's not something that you always get to do, but you need to do. The difference between nursing and the physicians is that when they're in between cases, they can go and chart, do their dictations, put in orders, sit down, and eat. But you cannot do that when you're circulating the case because you have to finish the case. After the surgeon's left the room, you're still working on, you know, helping the patient wake up, getting them cleaned up, moved over onto the stretcher, getting them transferred over to the recovery room, giving report, and then going back to the room, cleaning it up, and then opening it up for the next case, going over to the pre-op, getting your next patient, bringing them back into the room, getting them prepped, off to sleep, ready. Then you notify the surgeon that you're ready to get started again. So there's no break for the staff in between cases. At the end of this first day, now mind you, there was no unit tour. No one pointed out where everything was. I wasn't introduced to how to log into the computer system. I wasn't even given a hospital tour. And that matters because this particular HCA facility is huge. It's huge. I spent 15 minutes of my 30-minute lunch break just trying to find my way back to the unit from the cafeteria. So, needless to say, by the end of this shift, I wanted to quit. I thought, oh, wait. Let me back up just a little bit. As I was talking to the nurse, and I was asking her how long she'd been working at the hospital, she said, I just started working here in March. I was like, oh. Wow. So how long ago did you graduate? And she tells me, oh, I just graduated. Okay. So the manager and the charge nurse thought it was appropriate to put a new hire in the room with one of the most difficult surgeons without being oriented to the unit, and to be precepted by a brand new hire who had just graduated from nursing school. I want you to let that sink in. Now, to her credit, she is a very good nurse. I was really, really impressed because she's a baby nurse, and she was able to handle this situation very well, in my opinion. She did great. But it doesn't excuse that type of decision making because it's not appropriate. I took a week off after that because I'd had previous surgeries already scheduled. So I couldn't come in because, again, I'm still working as a first assist independently. So my schedule is already set. So gave me a week to pray a lot about whether or not I was going to come back. I decided, okay, let's go. I have an idea that will make this tolerable. I have a solution. The way that the unit is set up, there's a total of 30 operating rooms. The way they've numbered these operating rooms is very, very confusing. So one of the struggles that I had the first day was finding things, because you have equipment and you have supplies, but they're all over the place. You'll have some things in one closet and other things in a different closet, and you have things in between the rooms, and then you've got things in the main storage area, and then you got things on the second floor, and you got things on the third floor. You gotta look for things, and they're not all in the same place. And it's very confusing because when you first walk onto the unit, when you're first walking towards the operating rooms, if you go and look to the left, there's operating room 17. And if you look to the right, you're at operating room 10. It doesn't make sense. Like it's just, I just don't understand how they even came up with this, but it is what it is. So I'm thinking, how can I do this? How can I, because I know that I don't have a lot of time for orientation. For seasonal nurses, for agency nurses, for traveler nurses, you get 3 days of orientation. So I've gotten 1 day. I don't have ability to log in yet. Hadn't gotten that yet. So I can't do any charting. And I have not gotten any kind of unit tour, and I'm being precepted by someone who just graduated from nursing school. So anyway, I come back on my second day on the floor, and this time they put me in a totally different specialty, but the nurse that they put me with was also a new grad who had also just started working on the unit. So less than a year as being a nurse and less than a year working on the unit. This particular time, I was more familiar with the specialty that we were covering. Not everything, though. And so together, we had to figure things out. Now, here was another advantage we had. The first assistant on these cases with this surgeon was excellent. She was a former employee of the hospital, so she knew where things were and she knew how things were run. So she was able to really help us get things, tell us who to call, where to look for things, how to put things together. And if she hadn't been there, I don't know how that day would have gone. We were working with a general surgeon and we were doing robotic cases. I do robotic surgeries, so I know how to work around robots. But some of the tools that we had to bring in were not familiar to me, and they weren't familiar to the nurse. So I have a question. What do you think happens to patients when you don't know how to use the equipment, when you don't know how to use it, and the surgeon doesn't know how to use it either? And that happens. It happens because hospitals are constantly changing supply chain. They're constantly bringing in new equipment. They don't orient everybody. Not everybody knows how to use it. You can't find the instructions. So this is common. And this is how patients get injured. And this is why nurses feel like we are working in unsafe working environments. This was another day. Now, this is my day two. Still can't log on to the computer. Still don't have access. And I still can't get into the Pyxis where we get our medications. And I still can't log in to my email. I mean, there's all these things that I still cannot do. Everyone's constantly running around. I can't find the people that I need in order to help me. Either they're not in town, they're not in their office, they're not available, and there's no time. So day two. So now here I am thinking there's absolutely no way I could be done with orientation in 3 days. No way. So, of course, I left day two thinking, I quit. I can't do this. I quit. Every single day I came home telling my husband, I can't do this. I can't do this. It's not going to work. And we'd pray about it and I'd go back. So I went back for my third day. And on the third day, I mean, and mind you, every time I'm working, I'm with somebody completely different who's precepting me. In nursing, that's not good. You typically will have one preceptor and they go through orientation with you and they teach you things and they know where your needs are. They know where your weaknesses are, where your strengths are. And they really focus on training you up so that when you're ready to be on your own, you're able to provide safe care to patients. When you are being passed around amongst a bunch of people, most who don't know the hospital system because they haven't been there that long, others who are travelers themselves or agency, how are you supposed to be able to pick things up? How are you supposed to be able to take care of your patients? How are you supposed to keep morale high? I don't know. And one of the things that I will say is that as soon as the census starts to drop, charge nurses and management start sending people home. How do you send people home before their shifts are over when you have other people who are running ragged? If you have one person, for instance, on that first day, we had 5 cases that we had to do, but they were sending people home. Why not break it up? Why not assign 2 rooms for this surgeon so that they can go back and forth between rooms? You have one team circulating one case while the other team is getting the room ready for the next case. Then you break up the work, right? So that you're not overburdening your staff. And you allow the surgeon to be more efficient so he's not pissed and he doesn't decide that he's going to take his business elsewhere. Because that's the other thing that people in management and leadership don't seem to care about. If you piss the doctors off enough, they will go somewhere else. And in the market where I work, there are plenty of places for them to go. And they do. They leave, they go other places, and the other places are happy to accommodate them. So if this is about earnings, if you're really concerned about maintaining your business, if you really are projecting that you are going to be able to weather the storm of this inflationary market that we're in, how exactly are you going to do that again when you're pushing your surgeons away and they're the ones who are actually the reason why you have revenue coming in the first place? So I went on to work a total of, let's say, 6. Yeah, I think I worked a total of 6 days on the unit. I got my access to finally be able to chart around day 4, but not fully, just some. I could chart on one system, but there was another system I needed to be able to chart on. I didn't get access to that until the day before my last day of working. I got access to the Pyxis maybe 2 days before that. So had I really gone ahead and accepted the 3-day orientation, imagine how things would have gone. Nothing would have been charted, right? And all of the charting is so important because later on, if they decided to bring something to court and they saw that my documentation was inaccurate, do you think that they would be willing to give me grace and say, well, she was new and she didn't know how things went? Or do you think that the lawyers would turn around and say that I was trying to hide something? a recent report, a recent lawsuit from a CRNA locally was made that argument that because some of the documentation was missing, that they were trying to hide something. When you work in healthcare, you can actually see how that can happen. Our computers do not consistently work. Our charting, oh my goodness, that first day that I was working, it took so long for the computer to load. I didn't know how we were going to be able to chart. There are times when you have downtime and you have to go to paper charting. There are times when the system that you're using is just not working. There are times when you're switching over from EHR systems and the information is not getting input. But it doesn't matter because several years down the road, when they depose you for a case, they're not going to care. They're not going to care that you just didn't know how to chart. So, I have to consider what effect this will have on me and my nursing license if I continue to work in this environment. I'm consistently not getting the support that I need, even when I request it. And I talk to my colleagues. I talk to the travelers. I talk to the agency nurses. And the story is the same. They barely got 3 days of orientation. They were thrown out there. They had to figure it out. Now, most of them who are able to just jump in and figure it out, they already had experience using this computer, just the computer charting system. So that made it a lot easier because then it's more so about trying to find things. Not that that's a little thing, though, because it's a big thing. And I'll tell you later on why that is. But right now, I kind of want to go back and share a few more things from an article that I came across talking about the safety of patients is at risk. It was a report by Ethan Popowitz. It says, with fewer healthcare professionals on staff, the likelihood of a medical error increases. A recent study from Johns Hopkins Medicine suggests that medical errors are now the third leading cause of death in the U.S., accounting for more than 250,000 deaths annually. To put this in perspective, more patients die from medical errors than from a stroke, Alzheimer's, or diabetes. According to the doctors themselves, the staffing shortage is one of the major contributors behind medical errors. In early 2022, Survey Health Global and Apollo Intelligence released a report on the mental health of healthcare professionals in six nations across the globe. From the report, 34% of doctors worldwide observed increased medical errors and attributed the cause in part to staffing shortages and constant stress. Studies have found correlation between poor mental health and burnout, leading to medical errors and diminishing patient safety. Beyond medical errors, the ongoing staffing shortage is also worsening the patient experience and the quality of care. Respondents to the survey also reported that shortages have led to longer wait times for patients to receive care or outright delays in access to diagnosis and treatment. 30% of respondents said staffing shortages and the resulting delays have increased patient suffering and negatively impacted patient health. Overworked and understaffed medical teams may also make more avoidable mistakes when cognitive failure is high. Cognitive failure can be a result of stress, a lack of expertise to adequately deliver care, a heavy patient load, or poor mental health, among other factors. When cognitive failure is high, healthcare workers may be more likely to find shortcuts and safety procedures, insufficiently monitor patients after a procedure, or suffer injuries from physical hazards. Do you guys know about the Redonda Vaught case? That was a really, really important case that happened this year where they actually tried to criminally charge a nurse for a medical error. I am happy to say that she was not put in jail, although they were trying to put her in jail for a medication error which a lot of the reason it happened was because of hospital policies that were in place. It was a setup. And if you're going to start charging nurses criminally for making mistakes, we're done. We're all done. We would all be in jail. The doctors and the nurses. I promise you, we have all made a mistake at some point in our career. And if we have to worry about being criminally charged for that mistake, we can't do this. It's not safe because the hospital systems aren't even setting us up to be successful. While a doctor or nurse who has left the workforce can be replaced, knowledge cannot. In an article published in The Atlantic, Ed Young describes how the collective knowledge loss can be damaging to both providers and patients alike when experienced healthcare professionals quit. During the height of the pandemic, many veteran healthcare workers opted for early retirement. Some older physicians cited personal health concerns or worries about contracting the virus. Others stated that stress and burnout from heavy patient loads and long hours pushed them into thinking about or pursuing retirement, according to a 2021 poll. Don't you love how they ignore the elephant in the room? Vaccine mandates and the injuries that occurred to staff following those forced vaccines also pushed a lot of providers out of the workforce, but that's not reported. I promise you, if you look at most of these reports, you will not see that. However, there is a recent report that 22 states have actually submitted a request for CMS to get rid of the vaccine mandate for the healthcare workforce. Finally, we don't know if it'll go through, but at least they're trying. Okay, now let me get back to the article. Okay, it says, regardless of their reasons, when a healthcare professional leaves the workforce, everyone loses. In their article, Young writes that the wave of retiring healthcare workers has lowered the average experience level of hospital employees. When inexperienced recruits are trained by inexperienced staff, the knowledge deficit deepens. And this can extend beyond medical expertise. The loss of veteran healthcare providers is also a blow to younger and inexperienced workers looking to develop much-needed social skills learned on the job. Young says that the ability to question inappropriate decisions or for an inexperienced provider to recognize when they're out of their depth can be crucial to preventing medical mistakes. Their more experienced colleagues can help build these safeguards by serving as a resource for advice, guidance, and education. Lower quality work can have devastating outcomes for patients, leading to increased medical errors, reduced mortality, increased readmissions, and more. And I went in to check on one of the nurses, and this one particular nurse was managing a very complex surgical case. It involved three different surgeons doing three different procedures on three different areas of the body. If you were to break that up into different days, that patient would have had three different nurses for each procedure. When I went into the room to check on her, they were in the process of finishing up the final procedure. Now, this is a very competent nurse with a lot of experience working for this facility. She was no longer on staff. She was picking up as an agency nurse. But she had been working there in the past, so she knew the computer system, she knew the rules, she knew all of the things. But she was working for agency because it pays more if you work for agency. By the time she finished this case, she was spent. Emotionally, physically, she was angry, she felt hopeless. I knew what the problem was, and when I offered up the hope that maybe we could fix things, she immediately shot me down. She said, they will never do it, they never have, and they never will because they do not care. This nurse was at the end of a contract assignment at this hospital, and she was planning to go and work for a competing hospital system in the area. Now, when we go back to these reports, these earnings reports, and they talk about how this staffing plan that they have is supposed to help with earnings. And then you hear this story. What do you think? What they should have done And if I was running the hospital, this is what I would have done. Is they should have assigned at least two nurses to that room. Even three, even be willing to give them three to help circulate that case. Had they done that, it would have actually decreased the operative time of the case from, let's say it was 5 hours, to let's say it shaved off 40 minutes of the case, because the surgeons wouldn't have had to wait as long when they needed something. If the case took 5 hours and we took off 40 minutes, I wonder how much that would have cost the hospital in savings, how much they would have saved in OR costs. The cost of paying three premium nurses for 4 hours at $75 an hour is $900. Since you already have one assigned at minimum, the additional cost of the hospital would have been $600 for that surgery. Now let's make another assumption, just for the sake of the scenario. How much would insurance reimbursement be to the hospital for this procedure? I'm going to be modest and say that they would get around $50,000. And I'm just saying that because if a 45-minute joint replacement fetches about $40,000, it's fair to assume this procedure was valued a bit higher. Now, if you want to get an idea of costs, legally every hospital is supposed to have cost estimator calculations on their websites, so you can play around with procedures and see what they actually get paid. But I want to show you something. Let's look at the ramifications when you choose not to step over those dollars and chase after pennies. Had they given this nurse two additional nurses to help her circulate this case, it would have been far more efficient, which would have led to the surgeons booking more cases. They'd be incentivized. They'd be happier. They'd treat the staff better. The morale overall would be higher. The staff would want to stay because they're having fun at work. There'd be less mistakes, safer patients, better reviews, more customers. Instead, here's what you got. The surgeons left, reluctant to ever do combined cases like that again. The patient was not able to get the highest level of care due to the operative constraints that could have been avoided had there been more people available to help. The nurse planned to quit, taking with her a lot of knowledge and experience. Her feelings were palpable and led me to believe there was no hope for the system, which confirmed that my decision to resign was the right one. So in the end, you lost two nurses in one day during the busiest time of the year over $600. Let that sink in. Thanks for listening to Nurses Out Loud. Our show will be on air Monday through Friday at 10 a.m. with an encore at 10 p.m. Shows go to podcast typically a day or two after the broadcast is heard on talk radio. You can hear them on Spotify, Stitcher, Pandora, and many more. Be sure to subscribe and rate the show on Apple Podcasts for me. Our lineup is going to be awesome. On Mondays, you're going to hear from me, Nurse April. Then Tuesdays, you have Nurse Cammie and Nurse Emily. Wednesdays, Nurse Kimberly will fill the airwaves. And Thursdays, you get to spend time with Nurse Michelle. Fridays, you have the infamous Nurse Jody O'Malley, who inspired us all to speak out, unabashed and unafraid to challenge the narrative and fulfill our mission, which is to shine a light into the darkness.
It's time.